done is we've worked to get a new class of licenses created for community radio stations. But what I would like to do when I start is just talk a little bit about broadcast history. It's not something that people really learn very much about in high school history class. And I think that it tells us a lot about what it tells us a lot about the way that governments control information and entertainment and basically and our culture. And so I like to just go back to around where I think the story starts, which is around 1900 or so, 1890s, 1900, when radio was invented. When radio was first invented, it was really it was a combination of inventions of about 10 or 20 different inventors. It really wasn't Marconi so much as a whole bunch of different people working, competing to develop radio. And it was originally, actually Marconi originally wanted to use it as a tool to communicate with the dead. He wasn't very successful with that, but what he was successful at doing was getting a signal from point A to point B. And so his original vision of radio was that it would be for communicating between ships and shores from point to point. He basically thought of it as a communicating device, not as a medium of entertainment. That idea basically came from his office boy, a guy named David Sarnoff. And Sarnoff had this idea that you could build this box and you could sell people these boxes, and out would come music and entertainment and news and information. And his business model was that you would sell the box to people, they would buy it, and you would provide the content for free, at just sort of as a public service to get people to buy the box. And that is how broadcast radio really started for the first bunch of years. At that moment, people, America was different. People were culturally different. It was kind of unheard of to let strangers into your house to talk to you. And the idea of having a salesman in your house was even more more horrifying to people. So people at first thought that advertising on radio would be a total flop. And Sarnoff was among the people that refused to even consider putting advertisements on radio. They thought that most Americans would never allow that a box that was a salesman to be in their house. Of course, the people that overestimate the taste and discernment of the American consumer are always the ones that lose. And within a few years, someone tried broadcast radio with advertisements, and it was remarkably successful. And they made tons and tons of money, not really necessarily by getting people to listen, but by convincing the people that wanted to advertise goods and services that they were getting people to listen. And so they started selling the product, which was the public's ears. They weren't really trying to sell entertainment per se or information per se. They were trying to sell the attention of people, and that was a kind of a novel idea at that moment. As soon as that happened, there was a crisis in spectrum allocation. Up until then, the main people that were using the spectrum were university professors, amateurs, quack doctors, all sorts of people were just sort of experimenting to see what the new medium would bring. But when advertising hit, there was very quickly a spectrum crisis, because every venture capitalist wanted to jump on board and stake their claim in the ether, on the spectrum and get their little piece of it. And so in 1927, Herbert Hoover said, "Radio is the first industry I ever ran up against that begged me to regulate it." And it's interesting that they begged to be regulated, because what the kind of regulation they were asking for was to shut the door. Whoever had spectrum at that moment would keep it. Whoever had not gotten any yet would not get any. And so it was a very effective way of keeping out competition on the airwaves. And after much lobbying, and after a very heavy political battle between a group of broadcast reformers, including some labor unions and professors and universities, there was a very contested political battle over who would control radio, and guess who lost? Anyone? We all lost, and basically a handful of corporations got the vast majority of the frequencies. And they said no one else. What they did then was, and it was interesting, the next 20 years, a lot of people talk about it as the golden age of radio, but there's another story to tell from that. Actually, Lee DeForest in 1945 or so, after 20 years of almost exclusively commercial radio, came out one day and issued this big statement that said, "What have you done to my baby? What I thought was going to be this wonderful medium that would educate the masses and have the working class listening to opera and have have all kinds of news and information that would inspire people and enlighten public debate. Now it's nothing but a huckster salesman that is, you know, hell-bent on selling soap to ladies in their living rooms." And a lot of people realized that it was just a crying shame what had happened to radio at that moment. And so when they allocated the FM band, what they did was they decided that they were going to leave a spot where non-commercial messages could fit, which was from 88 to 92, which is where you hear to this day most public radio, community radio, and so on. And so what happened then was they created FM, which was obviously a much better technology, much less noisy, much less subject to thunderstorms, creating static and so on. And what they did with it was they, at first, they designed this very interesting license. It was called a Class D community license, and it was mostly given out to high schools and colleges and neighborhood groups and groups along those lines. And what they did, there was this sort of giant blossoming of small-scale, local, community radio that was just really very neighborhood-based. And that went for about 20 years, from 45 to 65. And there was basically like a much more grassroots form of radio than we really had. And some groups started really going after these licenses and creating the community stations that we know of today. Sort of the Pacificas and the WORTs and those sorts of stations. Along came in 1967 or so the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation. These guys, they looked at the broadcasting of other countries, and they said, America, I mean, it has all these little community radio stations, and it has all these commercial stations, but it doesn't have anything like the BBC. And we really think that it's important that there be a national news service that comes into existence. Actually, they were mostly thinking about TV, and so they created PBS, and they pushed the government to create PBS, and they got their way. And they created, almost as an afterthought, National Public Radio. These were, relative to community radio, really well-funded, and they proceeded over the course of the next 10, 15 years to professionalize and create this new sort of radio empire in the non-commercial band. And at a certain moment in the mid-70s, they said, you know, all these little 10-watt stations, all these community groups, and they're sort of in our way. And we'd really like them all to just move out of our way. And so they went to the FCC, they made their case, and they got the entry-level 10-watt community radio license thrown out. And although a couple of them still survive to this day, they haven't issued a new 10-watt community license in about 25 years or so. So sort of fast-forwarding to the mid-80s, people started to realize that this that NPR had staged this little coup, and that there was no way for sort of ordinary community groups to start up. And that's where a group of where people sort of started this sort of nationwide resistance in the form of pirate radio. And the very first one was this guy that I know about. There's always been pirate radio. But the way pirate radio used to be, it was sort of more like, oh, you know, there would be some kids in their garage. They would figure out how to, you know, how to build the radio station. And they would be broadcasting, and the FCC agent would come and you know, open the door and say, all right, kid, you're real smart, but you're going to get in a lot of trouble here. If you don't stop right now, I'm going to tell your mom, and that's going to be the end of it. And it would sort of be, that would sort of solve it. There was other pirate radio. There was C. Allen Wiener this weekend. But what Mavon and Kentucky did that was really different. He was a blind 45-year-old African American man who lived in a housing project, and he decided he was going to start his own radio station, and he just started broadcasting with one watt just to the people that lived in this housing project, and he basically created a little alternative press inside his little neighborhood, and he went for about 3 years without anybody noticing outside of the project. The day that changed was when a friend of his got beat up by the police as he was walking home one night, and Kentucky went to the hospital and interviewed the guy and his son who had gotten beaten up, and you know, he took it back to the station, he played the interview, and the next day there were really big protests that got the local police incredibly, incredibly scared. And about a week later, the FCC showed up for the first time after 3 years of broadcasting and said, oh, you're going to interfere with airports, you're going to knock airplanes out of the sky, you've got to turn off that pirate radio station. And what Kentucky did, which was a little different than what many people had done before, was he took that up as a challenge, and he called a press conference, and he said, look, I've been broadcasting for 3 years. Nobody's noticed. It's the FCC's job to prevent interference, technical interference, caused by radio broadcasting. How come they never noticed me before, if that was the issue? I think what happened is someone didn't like what I was saying. And if there's one thing the FCC is not supposed to do, it's not supposed to be regulating content. It's not supposed to be telling people what they're supposed to say and what they're not supposed to say on the radio. And, by the way, I dare them to come and arrest me. And he stood out there broadcasting with his transmitter, and nobody came and arrested him. So he took all the cameras. He said, okay, everybody, follow me. We're going downtown. And he went to the police station. He said, okay, I want somebody at the police station to arrest me. He knocked on the door, and no one would arrest him. And they were like, oh, it's not our jurisdiction exactly. You know, that's a federal thing. He's like, okay, everybody, let's go to the federal building. So he went to the federal building down a few blocks, and he said, you know, someone, arrest me. I'm broadcasting without a license. And basically, they didn't want to deal with it. They were sort of like, well, I don't know what they said. They probably said, you know, come back, make an appointment, you know. and he turned to the media. He said, look, I'm going to keep on doing this until someone comes and stops me because I think it's my right. And interestingly enough, no one ever did for many, many years. And it was just too embarrassing. It was obviously he was right. And obviously they were targeting him, not because he was knocking airplanes out of the sky. And a whole bunch of people around the country sort of saw this story and said, huh, this guy's broadcasting without a license. This guy's not getting arrested. Hell. And it was interesting. The sort of next step of it was some lawyers approached him and said, look, we want to take this case to the courts. And there's an interesting legal argument they came up with. It's basically the FCC, under the law, it has the right to regulate the broadcast spectrum, basically to prevent interference is the rationale behind it. But they're supposed to do so in the way that is the least, that causes the least possible harm to the First Amendment. And they're supposed to create a radio system that is the most open to the public that it possibly can be. And these lawyers, they said, at the National Lawyers Guild, they said, we have a system where corporations own all the radio stations and everybody else owns none of the radio stations. Is this the least restrictive possible means available to regulate the airwaves? They wanted to take this. They didn't care where it went. They wanted to get it up to the Supreme Court, and they wanted to see what would happen. Well, they did. Kentucky didn't want to do that because he mostly just cared about his station. But another guy did want to do that, which was Stephen Donifer in Berkeley. And about 93 or so. And what Donifer did was he very deliberately and fairly publicly broke the same stupid law. And in his case, they did decide that they wanted to pursue him. First, they fined him $20,000. Then they tried to get an injunction against him. And when the case actually went before the judge said, "Well, gosh, that's the National Lawyers Guild has a very interesting argument. I'm not going to rule on it. I'm gonna have to think about this. And in the meantime, Stephen Donifer can continue to broadcast." So for about 4 years there was a federal judge that refused to grant an injunction against a pirate broadcaster. And that's when all the rest of us were like, whoa, we're doing that now. And within about a year, well, first of all, the first thing that he did was he went and he got a storefront. He opened up the doors. He said, "Everybody, there's no injunction against me from doing this. We're starting a radio station." And within a few months, he had 100 programmers on the air all the time in Berkeley, coming in and out. And, community radio licenses were pretty much reborn just without the licenses. And that's where a whole bunch of us jumped on board and started radio stations across the country. The one I was involved with was Radio Mutiny in Philadelphia, which ran from about early 97 until it was confiscated in mid-98. What we realized was, even though the law was unclear that this was a political opportunity to raise the issues and to give people a taste of what community radio could be if the airwaves were opened up. And so we decided to all break this same stupid law for as long as we could manage and basically use it as an opportunity to get the public to thinking about these issues and to get the FCC to reevaluate what it was doing. And Radio Mutiny was probably like one of the funnest projects I ever got to do because, within a couple months of starting a radio station, well, first, no one believes that you can do it. None of us knew anything about radio. We blew up 3 or 4 different amplifiers, in the course of it. No one knew any radio engineering, and we certainly made our share of mistakes. But after a few months, once you could turn it on and people would hear it around the neighborhood, all of a sudden, everybody starts coming down. They want to do their show about the music of lower Czechoslovakia or whatever, and bring out their polka records. And pretty soon, you just have like almost always you have a giant, diverse group of people. At our peak, we had about 60, 70 shows on 7 nights per week, and it ran off the back porch. After about 9 months or so, the FCC finally showed up. And they came to shut down our station. And, first they threatened to kick down the door. And, we kept the door closed because they don't have a right to come in. And then we did what all good leftists do when the law finally comes. We sat in a big room with about 20 of us and yelled at each other for about 3 hours trying to figure out whose fault it was. And then we came up with a strategy, which was that we were going to sort of follow in Kentucky's footsteps, and we were going to challenge the FCC sort of face to face. So about 3 days later, we set up we called all the press. And we set up our transmitter in front of Benjamin Franklin's printing press, which is conveniently located downtown in Philadelphia. And we set it up and we said, we told the FCC we were going to be there, and we dared them to bust us in public instead of coming in the middle of the night. And we put forth at that point a 7-point platform for how we were going to make the FCC's life really suck if they did not legalize community radio. And the first thing we said was that we were going to put we were going to host a conference and teach people how to build these stations. We were going to we had the ACLU on our side at that time, and so we were going to file a lawsuit against them. We were, I don't know, we said a bunch of things. The main thing that we said was that for every station like ours that they tried to capture or to shut down, we would open up 10 more around the country. We were going to go on tour, and we were going to start just like scattering these everywhere and create a law enforcement nightmare for them that they would never be able to solve. And of course, it was all bluster. I mean, we had no plan whatsoever. We had one transmitter. We had a nice group of people that were all like really scared and upset. But it was enough for us at that moment to sort of go out there and throw the gauntlet down. And that really sort of blew them away. They did not know what to do with us for a good 6 months before we heard from the FCC again, because they really just didn't expect that kind of a public thing to happen. So in the meantime, we tried to make good on our threats by going around and talking to people, setting up stations and doing all that sort of thing. And what we decided to do was just to keep on building these stations as long as we could. Now, the FCC was in a weird quandary. They had a new chairman. And the chairman was this guy, William Kennard. He had just come to the FCC from being a chief counsel at the National Association of Broadcasters. And we didn't know what to do with him exactly at first. And at first he seemed hell-bent on enforcing like no chairman had before, because he was doing all these giant raids that people came in with assault rifles and, you know, would raid three stations in Tampa simultaneously. But at first, I think he thought that would make him look cool somehow, because he was the enforcer. But the media that came out of it was terrible for him, and they just like it was a real David and Goliath story, and he did not want to be Goliath, and so he came up with a different strategy, which was to say, look, you know, the ones that want licenses, the ones that want to broadcast, I'm going to give them licenses, and we're going to figure out how to create a new community radio service. And at first we thought he was bullshitting for a good while, but some of us started, as he started saying it again and again and in all different sorts of contexts, and when the broadcasters started criticizing him for it, we started to believe that we had actually sort of swayed something through what we were doing. And so by the time that Radio Mutiny was confiscated in June of 98, we were actually pretty sure that same week they announced that they had opened up a formal rulemaking that they were going to create a low-power FM service. And so as we were mourning our station being dragged off in cartons, we started to be looking at these proposals really closely. And that's when we started Prometheus Radio Project. We decided that in some ways we'd lost the battle, but maybe we were about to win the war in terms of getting community licenses for radio stations around the country. I have to say, we also, pirate radio was really cool. I loved doing pirate radio. But at a certain moment, I felt like we hit a glass ceiling. When we approached, we had great shows. I mean, we had this guy from South Africa, Malinga. He had fought in the ANC. He would do Africa Report every week, and we learned all these things about African politics. And we had the condom lady who did a safe sex KTEL classic disco show every week. We had great, great programming. But we started to hit a glass ceiling, which was as we approached like the consumer groups, as we approached the Black Women's Health Project, as we approached all these other groups that we really thought should be on the air, they just were like, we can't get arrested for this. Really cool, but we just can't go there. And a few of us made this realization that community radio should not just be for the reckless, And for, you know, for people that are not afraid of going to jail for a little while, it should be for everybody. And that was one of the reasons that in spite of the years and years of headaches that it's cost me later, we decided that we were going after legalization. We were trying to create ways that community groups could go out and get these stations. And so that began for us a two-year process of engaging the FCC, wrangling over what kind of language should be in the rules, and it all culminated in January of 2000 with them passing a new radio service that would allow community groups to have radio stations. It was called Low Power FM, and it was 100-watt licenses. And what we at first we were a little dubious because it was not as good a service as we had hoped. It had been wrangled through the political process, and it was really we didn't think that there were as many stations as could have been allocated. In the top 25, in the top 10 urban markets in the country, there were about 25 low-power radio stations that would come through. There weren't going to be any in New York or Chicago. There was going to be one in Philadelphia. On the other hand, there were going to be about 5 in New Orleans, about 5 in Minneapolis. And we were like, did we win? Did we lose? I don't know. But by that time, we didn't have much control. You know, the rules were going in, and we were going to try to make the best of them. Then is what really surprised us. Usually the FCC is the one that makes the decisions about who gets broadcast licenses and who doesn't. They're a technical agency. They're the ones with the radio engineers and everything that, you know, sort of decide where radio licenses fit. And a bill went into Congress from the broadcasters to entirely kill the low-power radio service. And at first we didn't really take it very seriously because we thought that Congress never does this sort of thing. They don't micromanage, spectrum allocation policy. They set, like, really broad policy. And so at first we watched it concerned, but we didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And all of a sudden, it wasn't getting very many co-signers, a couple. Nobody wanted to say that they were against community radio. So only the worst Republicans, there was this one guy, Conrad Byrne, said, I've had about all the diversity I can stand. Only a couple of the real weirdos were against it at first, or were for this legislation that would stop low-power radio. So we thought we were okay. But then, all of a sudden, this nasty Democrat, John Dingell from Michigan, he introduced a compromise bill. And the compromise bill was that the only low-power radio stations that could go forward would be the ones that were in the country, in small towns, on what were called the fourth adjacent channels. I'm not going to go all the way into all that. But and the ones that were in the larger cities would all have to wait until there was a study to figure out whether 100-watt radio stations could interfere with 50,000-watt radio stations. And so we were flabbergasted, but this was a political idea that a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans could get behind because it seemed moderate. It seemed like it was a compromise. It was no compromise at all. It basically totally eviscerated the service, leaving only radio in the smallest towns. But so we started to fight it at that point, and it was losing, and we had a really interesting ally, which was it did manage to pass the House, but it was totally stalled in the Senate by, of all people, John McCain. John McCain, who knows why, but he decided that this time he was going to stand up to the broadcasters. He knew that the interference arguments and all that were bogus, and so he stopped the bill in committee, and he said, "There's no way that this is going to go through." So again, it seemed like it was okay. Then we hit the election crisis of 2000, and the legislative session just kept on going on and on and on. And the other side came up with a really clever way of putting the bill that stopped low-power FM into an appropriations package, which is not where you regulate spectrum policy, but it's where you decide what the government is going to spend money on. And they stuck it in there pretty much in secret in a rider to that. And we didn't really know about it for a while. And then it popped in there. And we campaigned against it. We did all sorts of things, but there was nothing we could do. Finally, it ended up that there was a deal between Clinton and the Republicans. Clinton was in favor of low power radio, but there was this backroom deal where Clinton traded away low power radio for a couple $100 million extra budgeted for schools and an amnesty for illegal immigrants. And he said, if you do that, then I will sign the anti-low power FM part of the bill, and we'll pass the whole thing. And so Low Power FM got further eviscerated into a very, very small radio service, which is what it is now. Now, that didn't stop people from applying. There are about 3,200 license applications that went in, and there are about 400 licenses that have come out, construction permits that have come out around the country. And we've built a bunch of them. You know, there's two this year that we put on the air, one in Oroville, California, and one in Maryland. But they're in really small towns, not over like 20 to 40,000 people. And it taught us a lesson about organizing, because we had to very oriented towards working in Minneapolis with the network, with the people we already knew. And what we had to do is we had to do what the Christian right does, which is go out into small town America and say, look, here's your chance to start a community radio station. So there are going to be low power radio stations. And so there's like this much of a victory in that Burlington, Vermont is going to have a kick-ass community radio station, and Northampton, Massachusetts is going to have, probably two really kick-ass community radio stations. Oroville, Opelousas, Louisiana, places like that. But the rest of the country is sort of held hostage by this study that's going to happen, and it's probably starting in the next couple months, and it'll probably take a year or so. And what we're going to have to do is once the study comes out that looks at low-power radio, we're going to have to fight for it and try to get the rest of the frequencies that we already thought we'd won and get them back and get them into the people's hands. So that's where Low Power FM is right now. We are starting to build stations, and so while I got all these people here, I should tell you we need all kinds of technical support. And one thing that we do is we do these Low Power Radio barn raisings, which is where we get everybody that wants to learn about radio from a region, everyone that's got these permits or everyone that wants these permits, we pull them all together and we put a station together over the course of a weekend. And that way, anyone, licensed, unlicensed, whoever, that wants to know how transmitters work and how to hoist antennas and how to make programming work, how to cut a news story, gets to, sort of see how it all works. And we do a bunch of these. The next one's going to be in Louisiana in a couple months. And the other main thing that we're doing right now is the FCC in the spring of 2003, they are going to reevaluate a whole bunch of rules about community radio. Not about community radio, about all media. They're going to reevaluate whether your local newspaper can be the owner of the TV station or the cable network. They're going to reevaluate whether the cable giants can own more than 35% of the market in the entire country. It's a sad thing, these cable companies. Right now there's this really onerous regulation that a single cable company can't control more than 35% of all cable subscribers in the United States. I weep for them nightly, because it's an incredible limitation on their markets. Yeah. So, what we're doing in order to try to fight this is we decided that we're going to go after one of the worst examples of what happens when you allow a single corporation to be a media monopoly. And the one that we've chosen, it's really worst in radio right now, because in the Telecom Act of 1996, they took away all the regulations on how many radio stations a single organization could own. It used to be you couldn't own more than, what was it, 8? Then it was 20, then it was 40, and now it's unlimited. And this one corporation, Clear Channel Corporation, based in San Antonio, Texas, now owns 1,200 radio stations across the country. And, well, okay, so what? They own 1,200 radio stations. They also own a third of all the billboards in the United States. They own 240 stations overseas, and they're getting into all these other markets, like outdoor advertising and so on. This corporation does not consider itself to be a media corporation. They consider themselves to be an advertising corporation. If you look at their website, they say, how many times has Clear Channel reached you today? And we just think that if they're telling us that there's no room for community radio, if there's no room for public-owned owned media, that and at the same time, they say that there's room for Clear Channel to own 1,200 stations, or if it can get them, they could own 2,400 radio stations, there's something really, really out of balance with that system. And so we're targeting Clear Channel over the course of the next 9 months or so to let the public know just what it is that happens. And what is it that happens? First of all, they go around busting every union that they can find, and they go around firing all their DJs. And what they do is they replace them with computers. They have a very interesting system. It's called voice tracking, where a DJ in Utah or something like that records all the you're listening to Stairway to Heaven, and he does that for 5-10 different stations around the country. Then they just at the rest of the places they take all the studio equipment, they take it, they throw it in the dumpster, and they just put a computer there, and it's just a bunch of audio files that get stuck onto the radio station. And so they get rid of all the people in radio, and they leave it basically to a couple of marketing analysts and a bunch of robots. And so we're ending up more and more with a radio culture that, well, first of all, it's just hell to listen to. And second of all, it like misses the whole point of what you can do with radio. I mean, after you've listened to, Clear Channel station for a while and it sounds sort of like voicemail or something like that, and then you listen to actual people on the airwaves, well, they don't have those voices from the Columbia School of Journalism. They don't necessarily sound as smooth. They don't have like weird sound effects going on in the background all the time. But they're actual people. They're actually people that you can connect with. They're actually people that you can learn something from, and that you can actually have like some sense of where you are and some sense of connection. So what we're doing is over the course of the next bunch of time, we're really going to try to illuminate what happens when there is nothing to stop these giant corporations from controlling so much of our media by having people look at the example of Clear Channel. At this point, what? How am I on time? You know. Why don't we take questions? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a. How does someone get started doing their own low power FM station? It's a ridiculously complicated process. It's also the most easy process there's ever been for getting a radio station. So it's the FCC really bent over backwards to try to make it easy, but they didn't really. the way that they do it is that every couple years they're going to open up what they call filing windows, which is a 5-day period where if you want to apply for a radio station, you've got to put in your application in that time frame. And that actually happened throughout the country. And it'll probably happen again in, 2 years or something like that. where they open up these windows. Then you put in your application. It's a free application. And you can't as an individual, but if you have any kind of a community group, like, a Rotary Club or, an Earth First Chapter or something, you can put in your application for it. And basically, if the frequency's open, you get it, as long as you, like, cross all your T's right and dotted all your I's and so on. An individual person can't, and they're all, it has to be some kind of a nonprofit organization, or and it has to be a non-commercial station in order to get it. But in truth of fact, a lot of these, organizations are really just, three people. Because that's how every radio station starts. It starts with, between one and three people that for some reason get it in their head that they want to start a radio station, and they, just start knocking on doors and getting people together, and, no one pays attention to them. They think they're weird. And then a year later, when the license comes through, all of a sudden, hey, I want to do a show. And you end up with, your group of, 50 or 75 people that, that run the radio station together. So, the way you do it, the FCC has this really weird channel finder tool where we have instructions how to do this on our website. Basically, you get your geographic coordinates, which you can just get off the internet, and you plug those coordinates in, and if there's a channel available, it just says, yes, you have a channel available. Yeah, it tells you what channel it is. So one really nice thing about it is that you don't have to hire an engineer. So a lot of places got construction permits for an FCC license without spending one single dime, which we thought was really important in terms of, no one wants to invest $1,000 before they even know whether they're going to get anything out of it. So that's, where the FCC gets things right, I try to mention it, and that's something that they did get right.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, who were the forces and what was the rationale behind making Congress pass a law that made LPFM illegal? What exactly were what were they afraid of?
I've had all the diversity I can handle. Basically what they said was that it would cause interference. And it was an incredible argument. It really made very, very little sense. Oh, well, okay, that's... Yeah. They were concerned about pirates. And certainly pirates, if you really, really don't know what you're doing, you can cause interference. And don't let anyone kid you about that. You really can cause interference as a pirate if you don't use a filter, use a compressor, use all the stuff. So... people say you can get on the air with a pirate radio station for, $100. They're wrong. You can get on the air with a decent pirate radio station that won't cause interference for about $900 or something like that. So it's important.
Hi. I wonder, can you talk a bit about broadcasting on other frequencies that are not, say, FM, but are elsewhere, shortwave, or possibly even creating your own and transmitting off of, say, 78 megahertz or something else that's not FM?
I don't know so much about shortwave, but there's going to be a panel on that at 10 on Sunday. And I also, AM is really hard because AM, the waves are so big that the antennas are huge. They're like 400-foot antennas. FM is really nice because the waves are about 10 feet long, and so a 5/8 wave antenna is 6 feet, something like that. So FM is a really convenient, place to broadcast. The other issue is, where do people have receivers? There have been several people that have asked, why don't we go to, some kind of a digital thing? And that's a whole nother story. One of the things that we really wanted to fight was the digitization of radio as it's being planned. There's a plan called IBOC, in-band on-channel. And unfortunately, what's happening is they're using the same band, but they're using small side bands between the stations right now to carry the signal of the new digital transmitters. And the receivers will work on the same thing. Now, when you go from analog to digital, you can fit five times as much signal into the same amount of bandwidth. And so all these years, the FCC has been telling us, no, you can't have a radio station. There's not enough bandwidth. Then digital comes along. To me, that looks like five times as many radio stations. But that's not what it looks like to commercial radio. To commercial radio, that looks like, oh, well, we'll put streaming sports scores in there. No, we won't put streaming sports scores. We'll put a little display on your radio that says you're listening to the number 7 song by Britney Spears, and you can buy that if you press this button now. So that is the future of digital radio. That's what all that, you know, newly available spectrum is going to be used for. And to my way of thinking, they want the revenue stream, and they want to make sure that nobody else uses that revenue and further dilutes, you know, who owns the media. So,
Are there any Clear Channel stations in New York City?
There sure are. I can't remember them, but in most cities they have 5 to 8. How many? 8? Which ones? Yeah, if you listen to a Clear Channel station, you know, you'll hear, because they brand themselves really strongly.
What types of materials are you allowed to broadcast? I feel like a very nice thing, but what seems like it'd be copyrighted.
You know, the obscenity laws are really, really funny. They've really changed. You know, the FCC is basically, they're not supposed to regulate content over the air. They're supposed to regulate for interference. They have certain responsibilities about making sure the public interest is served by having people not curse or whatever. But all that is like really sort of gone out the window in the past couple of years. Every once in a while, a politician gets all upset about it, and they want to appeal to the family values crowd, and they issue like 2 or 3 fines or something. Yeah. Oh, in terms of copyright? Well, with Low Power FM, it's like a blanket license that you get, and it's actually not all that much. I mean, it's kind of a lot. It's like $400 a year or something like that, and that should take care of like most of your copyrighted material. So it's actually much better than web radio. I mean, the web radio thing has been a total disaster. But in terms of like blanket licenses for community radio, it could be a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. What are the regulations like as far as renewing licenses for commercial stations? Would it be possible to kind of steal them from the companies, kind of like you can do with internet domains, or not?
People have really tried that in the past, especially in the 70s. There used to be a movement of groups that would challenge broadcast licenses, and it was really cool, but it didn't work. The broadcasters were so powerful that they created what was called an expectancy of renewal. And unless you have screwed up in a way that no other broadcaster has ever screwed up, you're pretty much set for life with your existing broadcast license. There have been exceptions. There was actually one of the coolest things, which I don't know so much about, was the United Church of Christ in the 60s challenged the licenses of TV stations that refused to hire black people. And they were actually fairly successful in that. They didn't lose their licenses, but they were forced to like change their policies and so on. But very, very few broadcasters have lost their license for almost anything. I'll bet Nan has a good story.
Yeah, I actually do, if you don't mind. The biggest loss of licenses for financial malfeasance is RKO. And given the time, and now there may be some really good financial malfeasance, that was the only way that
I'm asked to wrap up. Thanks a lot, people, for coming. If you want to learn more about the stuff, you can go to PrometheusRadio.org. We also have a bunch of literature there. And if you want to sign up to get updates, if you want to know when the license windows are opening, if you want to rumble with Clear Channel, come and tell us. And, you know, one more thing. We need computer folks so bad to help us with a bunch of our projects, because one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to create some radio equipment that can create a studio to transmit our link that runs over the internet, and so reliable streaming is a real interesting field for us that if you have some ideas about it, come talk to us. Also 802.11 based 2.4 gigahertz wireless links, we're trying to develop those so that these new radio stations that are going on the air can get on the air without spending, $50,000 to do it. So many, many interesting hacks coming, and if you want to work with us on those sorts of things, come talk to us over at the table. Thanks a lot.